Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Tad Tobey, president of the Caret Foundation. I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for today. Today's program is part of the Tobey Family American Values series, which we've been running with the Commonwealth Club now in our fourth year. This program has also been done in association with the Marines Memorial Association. And now, it is my great privilege and pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, General George Casey, Chief of Staff of the United States Army and former commander of the multinational forces in Iraq. General George Casey became the 36th Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army on the 10th of April, 2007. In the previous assignment, he was commander of the multinational force in Iraq, a coalition of over 30 countries, from the 1st of July, 2004, until the 10th of February, 2007. General Casey's military history is diverse and impressive. Throughout his career, he has served in operational assignments in Germany, Italy, Egypt, Southwest Asia, and the United States. He has commanded at every level from platoon to division. He was commissioned a second lieutenant to infantry from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service in 1970. His principal staff assignments have been as Chief of Staff, 1st Cavalry Division, Fort Hood, Texas, Operations Officer and Chief of Staff, the U.S. GE Corps in Heidelberg, Germany, Deputy Director for Political Military Affairs for the Joint Staff, Commander of the Joint Warfighting Center for J7, U.S. Joint Forces Commander, Director of Strategic Plans and Policy, and Director of the Joint Staff of the 30th Vice and the 30th Vice Chief of Staff of the United States Army. He commanded a mechanized infantry battalion at Fort Carson, Colorado, a mechanized infantry brigade at Fort Hood, Texas, served as assistant division commander for maneuver and support of the 1st Armored Division in Bosnia and Germany, and commanded the 1st Armored Division in Bad Kreuznach, Germany. General Casey holds a master's degree in international relations from Denver University, and has served as a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council of the United States. Please join me in extending a warm Commonwealth Club welcome for General Casey.
Well, thank you all. Thank you all very much for that, and thank you for coming out this afternoon to hear a little bit about your Army. And before I start, I'd like to recognize and say hello to Fran Harvey, our former secretary. I'm actually out here working on our future. I just came from a laboratory in Santa Clara where they're developing a hybrid electric drive system for our new combat system. And this system will be revolutionary, and it will give us the capabilities we're going to need to operate from conventional war to peacetime engagement in the 21st century. And Fran was a major architect of getting that up and getting it going. So great to see you. Thanks for coming out. This is my second trip to San Francisco, and coincidentally, my second trip to the Fairmont Hotel. And I have to tell you the story about how I wound up here, but I was out on a training exercise in the Mojave Desert. And one morning I found myself in a dirty uniform because I'd been out there about a week, and I was in a ravine in the desert drinking instant coffee out of a canteen cup that was all charred on the bottom from having cooked it in a fire, and I'm sipping it away. 2 days later, I'm upstairs in a suite overlooking San Francisco Bay in a pink bathrobe, drinking wonderful coffee and reading the San Francisco Chronicle. And I was patting myself on the back at how adaptable I was. Anyway, nice to be here. Nice to be here with you today. Our country, as of earlier this month, has been at war for 6 years. And your armed forces are beginning to feel the cumulative impact of 6 years at war. We live in a world where global terrorism and extremist ideologies are very real threats. And we cannot take our eye off that ball. And as I look ahead, and I've been now in this job for 6 months and been going through a transition process where I've had teams of people looking to the future and trying to get some sense of what the future's like, we believe that the future, the next decade or so, will be one of what I call persistent conflict. And what do I mean by that? What I'm seeing is a period of protracted confrontation among states, non-states, individual actors who are increasingly willing to use violence to achieve their political and ideological ends. We're seeing that today. And that persistent conflict will take place in the context of a global extremist ideology that is working to undermine our way of life. And these global terrorists are not going to give up, nor will they go away easily. Now, that situation, I believe, is going to be exacerbated by some acknowledged trends that people see coming in the future. What are they? A few of them. First of all, globalization. Globalization is a double-edged sword. Clearly, it will have positive impacts, and already has had positive impacts on the prosperity of the world. But it also runs the risk of creating have and have-not societies. A lot of the benefits of globalization are being seen north of the equator, where in South America, Africa, Middle East, South Asia, Southeast Asia, all the benefits are not being seen equally. Those have and have-not societies can lead the have-nots to be recruited by some of these global extremist organizations. Our estimates are that by about 2015, almost 3 billion people will live below the poverty level around the world. That's a fairly substantial number. Second trend is demographics. And you've watched these demographic trends over time here. The populations of some of these lesser developed countries are expected to double in size in the next decade or so. That's a substantial additional burden for these governments. It also creates a youth bulge that is exploitable by the global extremist groups. And a lot of these bursts are taking place in cities. And our estimates are that by 2030, 60% of the world's populations will live in cities. And you look at some of these cities like Karachi, Pakistan, that are just these sprawling cities that are very, very difficult for governments to keep up services and to provide for people. Next, the resource competition. One of the things I was looking at, this hybrid engine, it's much more fuel efficient. It uses a lot less fuel. Our estimates are that by about 2030, demand for oil is going to exceed the supply. And what we're seeing is the research that's going on alternatives and for additional sources probably isn't going to be able to bridge the gap. And that's a problem. Even as we look to cleaner fuels, things like natural gas, 60% of the national gas in the world is in Russia, Iran, and Qatar. So the competition for resources is just going to get worse over time. It's driven a little bit by the positive impacts of globalization. Now, the rising middle classes in China and India are consuming a lot more resources. It was interesting that I read something the other day that said that the middle class in India is larger than the population of the United States. Over 400 million. Climate change and disaster. That's coming. The desertification is moving forward about 50 to 70,000 square miles a year, pushing people out of their homes and causing population migrations. And finally, the last two, and the two are trends that probably concern me the most, are the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And there's about 1,100 or so known terrorist organizations out there. Most of them are pursuing weapons of mass destruction. We know Al-Qaeda is. And there is no question in my mind that if they get their hands on a nuclear weapon or a chemical or biological weapon, they'll use it against a developed society to unhinge us. And lastly, failed states, failed or failing states, where places where the government is either unwilling or unable to govern itself and to maintain sovereignty over its territory. These can become breeding grounds like Afghanistan was for terrorist organizations. So when you take the fact that we are at war and we're that this will be a protracted struggle and all the trends that we see coming will only exacerbate that, it makes for a tough few decades coming up. Now, as I say all that, I say that knowing that one thing, the only real thing that we know about the future is we usually get it wrong. And we've demonstrated that time and again. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee just had the Congressional Research do a study. And the question he asked them was, how often has the United States of America employed force during my tenure, which happened to be 30 years? The answer was 12. In places like Iran with Desert One, Lebanon, Haiti, Kosovo, Bosnia, Panama, Grenada, Haiti, Kuwait, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Iraq. A lot of those places weren't necessarily household names when they happened. And so whatever forces we build and whatever posture we have has to be able to adapt to unexpected contingencies. And that's the type of army that we're building now. One other point on this. As part of my transition, I had the group that was looking forward. I told them, look out to 2020 and tell me what you see. I had another group. I said, go back to 1994 and tell me what the country was doing back in 1994. Well, think back. We were basking in the glow of the great success in Desert Storm. The wall had come down, and we saw success in the Cold War. We were scanning the horizon for a peer competitor, not finding one. We were writing checks on the peace dividend, and we were looking forward to a very peaceful decade where we were the sole superpower. And as a result, we took the Army from 780,000 down to 480,000. And we took a lot of capability out of the CIA and out of the Agency for International Development, capabilities that we sorely need now. And so as I talk to folks, I say, you know, if we made that choice, and as a result of those choices, we did not have the Army that we needed on September 11th, and now we look to the future and we see persistent conflict a decade or so, we need to be very careful with our armed forces. Now, the Army. I will tell you that today's Army is out of balance. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is we are so weighed down by our current demands that when we are consuming our readiness as fast as we're building it, that we cannot get back the strategic flexibility and the readiness that the country needs for future contingencies. And it's also straining our all-volunteer force. This is the first time in our history since the Revolution where we have had to recruit an all-volunteer force in a protracted conflict. It's a different challenge for us here. Now, that said, And I'm trying to be very careful in my choice of words here because people are taking them and trying to make something out of them that they're not. Out of balance isn't broken. And it's not hollow. It's just we're not ready to do the things we know we need to do or do other things we know we need to do. And we got a plan to fix that over the next 3 or 4 years, but it takes time. And the lesson is when you make decisions that unhinge things, it takes you a decade or so to put them back together because it involves people. And I called Shai Meyer, who was the chief of staff in the late 70s, early 80s. He's the one who went before Congress and said, the Army's hollow. And I said, how did it happen? How did you get there? And he said, George, it's all about the people. You have to keep the people with you. And he's right, because it's the captains, the majors, and the senior sergeants that take 8 to 10 years to train. And if you lose those, it takes you a decade to put that back together. There's four things I think we need to do as an Army to put ourselves back in balance. And it's going to take several years. It's going to take the support of Congress and the American people to do that. But we're well on our way to be able to do that. First, we have to sustain the all-volunteer force. The soldiers of this Army are absolutely magnificent. It's the best Army that I've seen in 37 years. They are our ultimate asymmetric advantage. And so whatever we do here, we have to retain them. And one of the things that we've seen is that with all of these repeated deployments, the stresses and strains are hardest on the families. And so we recognize that families have an increasing role to play in the readiness of the force. And so we're going to increase what we're doing for our families. But number one, we have to sustain our all-volunteer force. Number two, we are absolutely committed to preparing our soldiers for success in the current conflict. And we've come an awful long way here from when we just had a few up-armored Humvees in Iraq to now there's over 18,000. And that's a great tribute to American industry to be able to turn that around. We're equipping our soldiers with the things they need to have a decisive advantage, and we're committed to doing that. Third, we have to continue to reset our forces when they come back. You know, the old adage about when you ride a horse hard, you got to clean them up before you put them away. And if you don't, they're not ready the next time you take them out. We have to properly reset ourselves. It's a difference between an effective force and a hollow force. And last year, Congress recognized that and has given us the resources to do what we need to do. But it is expensive, but it's absolutely imperative. And lastly, we have to continue to transform. On September 11th, we had a Cold War Army. Make no mistake about it. It was a good Army, but it was designed for different challenges. And as we look to the challenges of the 21st century, we are moving to transform ourselves into an Army that can be effective in that environment. Now, I'm going to close just by saying a couple of words about quality, because I know there's a lot of chatter out there that says that, well, the Army is taking in soldiers of less quality. a family story. My stepfather was a West Point football player, big Montana boy. And when he was commissioned, they sent him down to New Orleans. And they went to the prison. And they said, okay, Lieutenant Murphy, your job is to form a machine gun battalion to take to Burma out of the prison. And they told the prisoners, your choice is you can stay here or you can go with Ray. We are light years from anything like that. Every soldier that comes in the Army has either a high school diploma or has a high school equivalency. There's no one's coming in that doesn't have at least that. And while the number of folks coming in with high school diplomas has gone down slightly, it's interesting. There's only about a 4-point difference on the average between someone who has a high school diploma and someone who has an equivalency. It's not substantial. Are we concerned about? We're not going to go lower than we are now, but I think we're doing fine. Now, let me give you a practical example about the quality of our soldiers. I was in Baghdad in August, And I had the opportunity to pin a silver star on a sergeant. And he's Sergeant Kenneth Thomas from Utopia, Texas. He was in his squad, were on a patrol on the Tigris River. It was a riverboat patrol. When they came under fire from the bank, about 70 or 100 insurgents. And the Iraqi policeman who was manning the machine gun bailed out. And so Sergeant Thomas jumped on the machine gun and began returning fire as the rounds were bouncing off the steel plates that protected the machine gun. They tried to punch through the ambush. They couldn't do it, so they diverted to the far bank. They got everybody out, and they got them in a depression. They were okay. They couldn't be hit, but they couldn't get out. So his leader looked at Sergeant Thomas and said, "Find us a way out of here." So Sergeant Thomas charged up the bank of the river under enemy fire. It's only about 100 yards across. Only to find that his way out was blocked by a fence. So he reached in his pocket, pulled out his wire cutters, and began cutting the fence. The fence was electric. It knocked him down. He got up. He continued cutting the fence while the gloves melted in his hand. He got an opening wide enough to get the squad through. The last guy got hung up. Sergeant Thomas went back knowing he was going to get shocked again. Got shocked, got up, dragged the guy through, and then organized the squad to assault the building so that they could be evacuated. Two hours of straight combat. Now, that's the quality of the men and women of your armed forces today. And you can be extremely proud of them and extremely proud of the job they're doing for this country. All around the world. Now, I thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take... Oh, my goodness, you've been busy with the questions here. But I'd be happy to take your questions. Thanks.
Our thanks to General George Casey, Chief of Staff of the United States Army and former commander of the multinational force in Iraq, for his comments today. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'm going to be conducting the question and answer portion of our program. As you just said, General Casey, we have a large number of questions from the audience here, so let's begin. First, I'd like to just sort of set some general guidelines of what I'm going to try to accomplish in this Q&A period. There's going to be a lot of questions I've noticed on the troop surge. There's going to be questions on the militias, both our militia, as some people term it, private contractors, and militias of insurgents. There's going to be a discussion about war strategy. And I also hope to get into a discussion about the difference, if any, between loyalty and patriotism. I think it's a really interesting philosophical question. But what I'd like to start with is you just mentioned that today you were looking at a hybrid technology program for military equipment. So this questioner wants to know, how will technology help us fight future wars? How will the Army balance investments in new technology with investments in manpower recruitment?
Yeah, that's a great question, because as you all in the business community know, the personnel costs are, and particularly the medical costs, are really driving costs for everybody way up. We'll leverage technology several ways. One is the network. And our goal is to empower our soldiers with the knowledge that is available across the network. And if you think, I don't know if you have Verizon out here with the guy that goes out and he's got the whole network behind him, that's what we want our soldier to be like. And so we're trying to leverage information technology to empower our soldiers so they have situational knowledge and understanding of what's going on. For example, we're trying to get to the point where we can take a little unmanned aerial vehicle, maybe about the size of a beer keg, and have a group of maybe 10 soldiers out, and they can fly that thing down the alley, look up on top of the roof, and they can see what they're up against before they go down there, and can find an IED, those kinds of things. That's powerful, and that's what we're working toward. And we're trying to give the soldier the ability for him to dial up and pull the information that he needs from the network. I mean, it's available now, but we have to do it in a way that it's available in the field and in all environments. The second way we're leveraging technology, I mentioned that hybrid electric engine. In the 21st century, our soldiers are most vulnerable when they're on the road against these asymmetric IED threats. The less soldiers you have on the road, the less vulnerable you are. The less gas you have to haul, the less logistics support you have to provide, the less soldiers are on the road. And this system, we're putting all of these systems on a common chassis, so they all have basically the same parts. So that will reduce our footprint. So those are just two of the primary ways that we're leveraging technology. But soldiers plus technology give us an asymmetric advantage over any enemy that we'll face, and we have to continue to push that.
General Casey, we have several questions here about the training of our troops, several, as a matter of fact, about the National Guard. Since National Guard members have been called, maybe inappropriately so, but typically weekend warriors, that would lead some to believe that their training is not adequate for combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. And let me just blend in this other question. Someone is making the statement that the Army Reserve and the National Guard units have been training with out-of-date weapons system, thus resulting in reduced operational readiness. Would you agree with these statements or not?
Not necessarily. But the thrust of these questions are that we are using our reserve components in a way entirely different than they were designed. Our reserve component policies and procedures right now primarily date back to the early 50s, after the Korean War. And that was a force where there was a general mobilization. You threw the switch, everybody got called up, and you started cranking out battalions and brigades to go to Europe and fight the Russians. That's clearly not what we're doing today. And we've changed the paradigm on them. And what we're wrestling with right now is how we articulate to our Guard and Reserve what that paradigm is. Now, as I said, one of my main imperatives is to ensure we continue to prepare our soldiers for success in the current conflict. It's one army. And so when our Guard and Reserve soldiers go into Iraq and Afghanistan, they are well-trained and they have the best equipment that's available. We made a decision probably back in early 2004 to give the latest equipment to the Guard brigades that were going over to Iraq before we outfitted the active force with them. And I just happened to be up in Washington State, and they were issuing the first unit, and it was late at night, and I was walking among the Guard soldiers who were getting the wraparound sunglasses and the new helmets and all of the kit, and I heard one of the sergeants say, "This must be really hard if the active has given us the good stuff." So we have not always resourced the Guard and Reserve well in the past, but we're committed to do that. There's $14 billion in the next 2 years is going into National Guard equipment. That's a lot, and that will help put them back on a much more even keel. But it's one army, and we will prepare everybody for success before they go.
Well, as I stated and as everyone in the audience can see, there are so many questions here, so I'm going to really do my best to combine as many as I can and hopefully make good sense out of them. President Bush told us that this was going to be a war like no other war. Congress voted unanimously to go to war. So in Iraq, General, how would you define winning? Are we winning this war? Can we win this war if we don't win the minds of a majority of the Iraqi people?
Mm-hmm. Winning in Iraq is an Iraq that can secure itself, sustain itself, and govern itself in an Iraqi way, not necessarily in a way, you know, in a United States way. That is the goal that we've been working for a long time. Clearly, since I went there in June of 2004. And we have been making progress toward that goal in small steps every day. But this is a long-term proposition in Iraq. And if we have conveyed to folks that this was going to be quick, you know, the war itself, the ground war itself, we expected that to be about as quick as it was. But the aftermath was always going to take a long time. One of the things that I was not fully prepared for when I went over there was the state of the infrastructure. I had this notion that Iraq was an oil-rich country, that they would have invested in their electricity, in their roads, in their sewage. Not the case. Not the case at all. Lots of things had to be done. Now, can we win? I believe absolutely. If we have patience and will. And I've been saying that since 2004. It's going to take longer than we want. We will succeed when the Iraqis succeed. But it won't be at the pace that we want, and it will take some patience. Now, do we need to keep the force levels that we have there now there for that entire period? The answer is no. And that's why a lot of our effort has been spent on training Iraqi security forces so they can take over the security mission with progressively less and less help from us. And in my view, and again, I'm not the operational commander there anymore. I haven't been since February. But I have always felt that we will succeed when we can get the force levels, coalition force levels, down to levels that are sustainable at home and acceptable to the Iraqis. And that will not take, I don't believe, a lot longer. But we will succeed when the Iraqis succeed, and if we have the patience and will to stick it out, and they will. This may be a little bit longer, but let me just say, we forget. The Iraqis lived under Saddam Hussein for 35 years. It was horrific. And if they know nothing else, they're not going back there. Now, there are fears and prejudices from that time that they're working hard to overcome, but it's not easy. There's not a lot of trust. And it was trust that was bred during the time of Saddam Hussein. But I've watched them. When they want something to happen, it happens. Elections in January 2005, constitution elections in December 2005. I believe with our continued support, they will succeed. And when they do, we will have a strong ally right in the center of the Middle East.
The elections were held. The Iraqi council was voted in, but I understand it's primarily Shia. Is that correct, first of all? And is it your point and the point of others that the council should be more inclusive, that there needs to be a joining together with more Sunni in Iraq in order to form an inclusive and a truly representative government?
The parliament and the Council of Ministers is a result of the elections in December 2005. And so it's based on the outcome of those elections. The Shia population of Iraq is around 60%, the Kurdish is around 20%, and the Sunni population is around 20%. So the parliament is roughly representative of that mix. Now, the question is, and it's a huge question, is that government perceived as being representative of the interests of all of the different groups? And the answer is no, it's not. And the Sunni do feel disenfranchised and not represented. And that is the political accommodation that is being worked very hard and that has to take place for the country to go forward.
Just as a heads up, before we go to a radio reminder, I do have a considerable number of questions about an issue that you've touched on in your talk, which is the deployment length of time of our troops. So we're going to get to that in just a second, and I want to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our speaker is General George Casey, Chief of Staff of the United States Army and former commander of the multinational force in Iraq. He's discussing challenges facing the U.S. military. And now, General, on to some questions about deployment. Submitted here by the audience, this question. As parents of a soldier, we are concerned about the current 15-month deployment requirement. Has a study been done on how effective this is, and are there plans to reduce this requirement in the very near future?
There are plans to reduce the 15-month deployment, and we're working very hard on that right now. I will tell you, as we looked at this back in April, really, with the surge, we made this decision to go to 15 months temporarily for three, I think, pretty good reasons. One, it gave the commander on the ground there additional flexibility. We were getting ready to have to extend a brigade a month, and that's no good for the commander on the ground. It's no good for the troops, because if your brigade gets extended and you're next, you know you're next, but or you know you're going to get extended, but you don't. And so by going to 15 months, we were able to give the soldiers and their families as much predictability as we could in an inherently unpredictable situation. The third reason, and probably most important, was we realized that if we didn't keep folks back in the States for at least a year, they would not have been as ready for combat, and they wouldn't have been as well prepared. And so 12 months at home became more important than the three more months in Iraq. Now, 15 months is not a sustainable policy. We recognize that. It is temporary. And in my own mind, as we wrestle through this, I have said to myself, I don't want anyone to have to do more than one 15-month rotation. And the challenge I have right now is to come down from 15 months while increasing the time at home for the soldiers who have already been there 15 months. And so we're it might sound confusing, but we're wrestling our way through that. And we will come off that, but I can't tell you exactly when. I will tell you that I think I'm not going to do it until I'm sure I can deliver. Because right now the worst thing I think I could do was to say we're coming off it and then have something happen and have to go back. So I think that's about the best I can say right now. We will come off it. Can't tell you exactly when.
High school graduation rates amongst Army enlistees has fallen from 90% to about 70%, according to this questioner's comments. If that's the case, can we still rely on an all-volunteer force to meet the Army's manpower needs? And I must tell you that there are quite a few questions that ask the same exact question. Mm-hmm. Should we reinstate the draft?
Yeah. The Army is doing nothing in our planning or forecasting that involves requesting a reinstatement of the draft. We're not looking at that at all. Now, we're just I've talked about this a little bit in my opening comments, but there's no question. This is a very difficult recruiting environment. The propensity to serve is down, and it's been on a downward trend for several years. The economy's up, so folks have other alternatives that they may not have. We're actually, it's closer to 80%, but it is in the 70s of the high school diploma graduates. But as I said, no one comes in without a high school level of education. And so, as I said in my opening comments, the quality of the force is as good as I have seen it. Albeit by our own indicators, we are seeing a slight degradation in the metrics. But I'm not ready to say, and I can't see myself saying anytime in the near future that we're ready to go back to the draft. We're going to meet our goals for this year, and the active force and the reserve, and our plans to increase the size of the Army are based on us recruiting about 80,000 men and women a year. Now, I would tell you, in the first 9 months of fiscal year 07, the one that ends in a couple of days, 250,000 men and women enlisted or re-enlisted in the active Guard and Reserve Army. That's 250,000 folks. So there's a lot of people out there that still understand what's at stake here and are committed to the ideals that this country stands for. And I believe we can make those goals and increase the size of the Army here over the next several years.
Well, the President did say that we're in for a war like no other. We now have a troop surge, which last year and even prior, you commented on. You questioned the troop surge strategy. How do you currently feel about the decision to proceed with that strategy?
Well, I've been very consistent in what I've been saying about the surge, and I went to Iraq in August to get my own firsthand look and to talk to our leaders on the ground there. And there is no question that the surge is having a positive effect on the security situation. There's no question about that. We always knew that would happen. Again, the men and women of the American Armed Forces have no match. The question has always been whether the Iraqi political leaders could take advantage of the opportunity that was created by the security efforts. And we will not succeed. You've heard this 1,000 times, I'm sure. We're not going to succeed in Iraq or Afghanistan by military means alone. And so that is what has to take place. Now, you know, I'm seeing some signs of that happening, but that's what has to happen. And so, you know, I've been, right before General Petraeus came back, I've been saying this exactly what I just said here several times, and there was a newspaper article that said I was belittling his accomplishments, which just wasn't true. Militarily, we have been absolutely successful. The political side is not General Petraeus' job.
Well, despite the holiest of Muslim holidays, Ramadan, Sunni insurgents, they've decided to deploy their own surge at this time by setting off a rash of suicide and car bombings in Baghdad. Is it realistic to assume that as the allies have their troop surge, that this is going to be effective against a troop surge or a violent surge that will be countered by our enemy, by the insurgents in Iraq?
War is a cycle. Action, reaction, counteraction. When we do something, the enemy counteracts and we react. And that's the cycle. And there was, I fully expected that the enemy would do everything that they could to unhinge the perception that the surge was succeeding. And so what's happening there was anticipated by the leaders on the ground well in advance. Will that be enough to overcome the military aspects of the surge? I think not. But that's the challenge, and I think we have to be careful about letting violence become the metric of our success. And I wrestled with this very hard for the whole time I was in Iraq. Clearly, you can't just forget about the violence. But by the same token, violence is generated by the enemy. And if you just count the violence, you kind of cede the initiative to the enemy. And that's why we worked on provincial transfers and things like that as ways of demonstrating progress. But the violence is unrelenting, but Iraq is a violent place. And there's going to be violence at some level in Iraq for a long time. And so we can't let violence become the metric of whether or not we're succeeding or failing in Iraq.
General Casey, did you know Sheikh Abdul Sattar Buzaig al-Rishawi, also known as Abu Risha? He was the young Sunni Sheikh killed 2 weeks ago. How big of a strategic loss has that been to our efforts there?
Yeah, I did not know him personally. I knew of him and worked closely with people who worked directly with him. He was, in fact, the leader in Anbar around the Ramadi area, which is the capital, that got fed up with the horrific violence that al-Qaeda was using, not only against us, but against the Sunni population of Anbar province. And he harnessed the disdain for that into a movement that we were able to leverage. But it was a combination of our military success in the city of Ramadi by pushing al-Qaeda out and his efforts to bring the tribes together. Now, how great a loss is it? It is a huge loss. One of the challenges in Iraq is leadership. You know, and under Saddam Hussein, strong leaders were not encouraged. And so when you have someone, a man of vision and courage like that, that steps forward and he's lost, it is a great loss to us. But there are others that will continue to step up. I don't see his loss as reversing everything that we've gained there in the last year or so.
General, recently Defense Secretary Robert Gates stated that he would keep 5 brigades in Iraq for a long time. That means around 20,000 troops, I believe. Is this realistic and necessary in your view? Do you agree with this?
Yeah, that's what I do agree with it. I don't know if 5 is the right number. 20, it's probably more than 20,000. But the Iraqi security forces are going to need our assistance at progressively lower levels for some time. You don't build an army overnight from scratch. And interestingly, it's not the units that's hard to build. It's the institutions. You know, setting up a logistical system to support a 200,000 person army is a, you know, you're setting up your own bureaucracy, and it's very, very difficult. That's the hard part, and that's what has taken us the longest. So somewhere I think in that number is an appropriate number, and I think over time, as the Iraqis take on more and more responsibility for their security, we'll do less and less in that regard and do more and more to support them.
Before we go to another radio break reminder, I do want to again give you a heads up that we have quite a few questions on the issue of loyalty versus patriotism, so I want to get to a few of those in just a
moment. Does anyone want to talk about the Army?
So you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our speaker is General George Casey, Chief of Staff of the United States Army and former commander of the multinational force in Iraq, who is discussing challenges facing the military. Well, we are going to talk about the Army. In fact, we're going to talk a little bit here about your successor in Iraq, General Petraeus. He reported to Congress recently on the state of the war in Iraq, and there's a website known as moveon.org, which I guess many people are aware of, which referred to the general in a very uncomplimentary way as General Betrayus, a very uncomplimentary statement. But it did bring home, according to this question here, an important point, and the issue is loyalty and patriotism. So put another way, if one were so loyal that they didn't tell the truth of what they thought, but told the President of the United States or the Secretary of Defense what they thought he or she wanted to hear, how would you view that in terms of the issue of loyalty and patriotism?
First of all, I thought that advertisement was disgraceful. And while General Petraeus and all our soldiers are over there fighting to help preserve the way of life that allows people to express their opinions freely, I thought that was over the top and was uncalled for and disgraceful. As someone who has had to give his own advice to the President and the Secretary of Defense on hard issues, one of the things that I tell myself all the time is, look, you have to have personal conviction in what you're telling the civilian leaders. You have to believe it in your heart, because everybody and their brother is going to question it for no other reason. And so there's no doubt in my mind that Dave Petraeus believed absolutely what he presented to Congress. And that's, you know, as we look at the traits that we build and desire in our officers, courage and integrity are right at the top. And so I don't see military advice being given because it's what people want to hear. We are putting soldiers' lives at stake every day. And believe me, that is never far from our consciousness. And so the notion that we might, in a war, tell someone something they wanted to hear just doesn't wash with me at all. Now, on the patriotism side, I mean, as I said, we're over there fighting to preserve the ideals this country stands for. And debate's debate. And free and open debate is a healthy part of any democratic process. I get questions all the time, what do the troops think about all the stuff going on back here? And I get two answers from the troops. One, they're not paying attention. They know why they're there. They know what's at stake. They're going about their business. Second one I get, not as frequently, the first one is the predominant answer. It bothers their families. Sitting back here in the United States, seeing people question what their husbands and wives are doing over there in Iraq and Afghanistan, it bothers them. But those are the two primary things. And again, our country has a great democratic tradition, and we fight for that. So we should never, in my mind, never question it.
There's a question here pertaining to Baghdad specifically. Iraq is divided into several sectors with varying degrees of military and security successes or failures. But isn't Baghdad the real crucial area? How are we doing in Baghdad, and what percentage of the total population lives there?
I haven't been there since August. When I talked to the division commander responsible for Baghdad, he was pleased with the progress he was making, but he was very quick to admit that they had a long way to go in Baghdad. Now, Baghdad is indeed what we call the center of gravity for the country. And part of the whole reason for the surge was to bring enough security to the capital that the political process could go forward. Baghdad runs about 8 million people. The population of the country runs 25, 26 million. So it's about almost a third of the population is right there in the center. The other thing about Baghdad is it really is right along the fault lines between the Shia population, which is predominantly in the south, and the Sunni population, which runs from Baghdad up to the north. And there's a lot of tension there in the areas around Baghdad. And in the previous regime, people that were loyal to Saddam Hussein, primarily Sunnis, were positioned in areas around Baghdad astride the major roads in and out of the capital. And so that provides a tension here that people are still trying to work their way through. It's a city of 8 million people. I can't give you a San Francisco analogy, but it's the area of Baghdad goes inside the Washington Beltway. I mean, the Beltway around Washington is about the outer limits of Baghdad. So it's a sprawling city. Not a lot of very tall buildings, usually, one or two-story houses, but, again, spread out over a large area. Ultimately, the capital has to be secure enough for the political process to go forward.
We have so many questions here about private contractors, about outsourcing, Blackwater in particular. I don't have the ability to put all of them together into one question. Besides, it would be so complicated. So hopefully we can...
Talk about contractors?
Yeah. I want to talk about private contractors. Why do we need them? Is this the first time we've had them to this degree? I understand there's something like maybe 20,000 or so of them. I'm not sure of that number.
Let's see, a couple of things. How did we get here? I mentioned in the mid-90s, we downsized the Army from 780,000 down to 480,000. One of the measures that was taken during that time was, frankly, a cost measure. And I think people in the business community are wrestling with exactly the same thing. To recruit a soldier, train him, bring him through a 20-year career, equip him, house him, and then give him his retirement benefits is a lot of money. And so the question became, are we better to invest in that and logistics soldiers, or can we hire contractors to fill that void when we need them? Because we don't need all of these logistical forces all the time. And as part of the Army coming down by 300,000, that decision was made. Now, with respect to contractors in Iraq, is this the first time we've used them? We used them extensively in Bosnia and Kosovo. but they're primary logistical contractors. More than 90% of the contractors that are in Iraq and Afghanistan are there for logistical or base support reasons. And there's somewhere in the range of, I think, 160,000 contractors of all types in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Again, 90% of them are logistical, have logistical tasks in nature. In Afghanistan, 98% are local Afghanis. In Iraq, about half are Iraqis. Now, you mentioned Blackwater. The security contractors are actually a very small portion of the overall number. I think in the range of 6,000 to 7,000. But I will tell you that every time I ask the question, I get a different answer. And so there's not the control over them that we need. And I think Secretary Gates said the other day that we are tightening our control over them. Now, the other question I get with respect to contractors is, would we have to divert Army forces to fill their job? And that's something we have to work our way through, because we don't train Army soldiers to provide personal security to other branches of the government. So they are providing a function. Now, like any other organizations, 90% of the folks are very good. The folks I came in contact with were mature, retired senior non-commissioned officers. There are others who have not been. And when we've had an egregious offense, we've investigated it and worked with the contractor to take appropriate action. But there's more work that needs to be done on control, exercising control over the contractors, and on exercising punishments when they act inappropriately. But fortunately or unfortunately, it's going to be part of our landscape here for a while.
The recent incident a few weeks ago with the death of 11 Iraqi citizens has brought up an issue here. I've just made some notes on this question. The issues to me are, what are the rules of engagement for private contractors? Are they well-versed as to what their responsibilities are and what the rules of engagement are, when they can fire their weapons and when they cannot? And then second part of this would be, should they have immunity from prosecution? Currently, the Iraqi government is suing for wrongful death the soldiers, or rather the military contractors that were involved in the killing of these 11 Iraqis. So could you comment, please, on the rules of engagement and also immunity from prosecution, please?
The contractors operate under rules for use of force. And in general, all rules of use of force and rules of engagement require some type of demonstration of hostile intent from the party that you're engaging. And beyond that, I don't want to get into much more of that. We don't normally talk about the specifics of rules of engagement because the enemy knows what we're doing. Now, I'm sorry, the second part was?
The second part was should there be immunity from prosecution?
They have immunity from Iraqi prosecution, not immunity from prosecution. I mean, we through the Justice Department can and have prosecuted contractors who have committed felony offenses. And those procedures are out there. But they're only immune from prosecution, like our soldiers, by the Iraqi government.
Let's talk a moment about the brain drain from Iraq. Many Iraqis have emigrated from the country, including the well-educated. Is there a brain drain deficit problem, and is that creating a big issue for the Army?
For the Army, I don't think so. Again, I'm 6 months or 8 months out of date. There was clearly an issue with people leaving the country, professional people. It was difficult to keep track of because they would leave and come back and leave and come back. And a lot of them would just go over to Jordan. The most concerns I heard were probably in the medical area, with doctors leaving and the number of people available to treat Iraqis was going down. I think it is a concern, but again, it goes back to the security situation. That's why I say the security situation has to be such that a political accommodation can be had, and people feeling secure enough to do their jobs is a big part of that.
Let's depart just for a quick moment from Iraq and talk about Walter Reed Hospital. There is legislation on Capitol Hill to fix Walter Reed's medical center and increase medical and family services from the seriously wounded. Can you discuss that issue briefly?
Mm-hmm. We have done an awful lot since March here to fix what was wrong at Walter Reed. But Walter Reed, it wasn't just about Walter Reed. What happened there really highlighted some challenges we have in our whole disability system. And what happened at Walter Reed really is what I'm seeing across the entire Army in differing scales. But the effects of 6 years at war are cumulative. You know, the second deployment's harder than the first, the third's harder than the second. And our systems are getting stretched. And what happened, one of the things that happened at Walter Reed, you had 5 years of casualties coming into an arcane disability system, and it backed up until it broke. And it's unfortunate, but that's what happened. And we weren't agile enough to say, wait a minute, something here is happening. It's fundamentally different than we set our systems up to deal with. We need to change. And unfortunately, we didn't change until it broke. Now, we've made great strides in establishing units to support our transitioning soldiers. And the problem has never been a question of the medical care. I mean, I go up there all the time, talk to soldiers, talk to families. The medical care they get is absolutely first class. It was the administration of that care over time that was confusing and frustrating to the soldiers. And so now we have a triad of people to support the soldier. There's a doctor, a primary doctor that works with his case, a primary nurse, and a squad leader, a soldier that just gets him from one place to another. And this is all over the Army. Every hospital in the Army has one of these transition units. We call them warrior transition units. And that is, that's helped us a lot, reducing the administrative burden and the confusion on the parts of soldiers and families. Now, the second part of this is, where do they go? They either transition back into the Army, or they transition back into society, usually through the Veterans Administration. That transition has not been smooth. And part of the problem is we in the Department of Defense have one standard for determining fitness for duty, and the Veterans Administration has another standard for deciding disabilities. And we were trying to do both at the same time. And one of the recommendations that you talked about is to separate those two. We do fitness for duty. The Veterans Administration decides disability. That we think that will help a lot in streamlining the situation. So those are the things that are in train. We're already seeing a lot of positive things happening, again, just with helping the soldiers work through the process. And it'll take us a little bit longer to fix that transition from the from our system into the Veterans Administration, but everybody's working very hard on that.
Well, General Casey, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for just one last question. It's kind of a doozy. The question is,
save the best for last. He's been shuffling through these and set this one off to the side.
On a lot of people's minds, but why hasn't Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri been captured? And would their capture, in your opinion, make a difference in this war?
I think, just think about how you would feel if you heard that they were captured or killed. I mean, I think you'd feel pretty good. I felt the same way the day that we killed Zarqawi. But as you saw, there is enough of a network out there where cutting off the head won't necessarily end the threat. Now, in the case of these two, I think it would have a significant impact on the network, but others will pop up. And I don't believe that we will ultimately succeed in this struggle against extremist ideology until the battle takes place within the Muslim world between moderate and extremist Islam. And more that is taking place. What's happened in Anbar province is a good example of that. That's the battle that needs to take place.
Our thanks to General George Casey, Chief of Staff of the United States Army and former commander of the multinational force in Iraq, for his comments today. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. Today's program has been part of the Tobey Family American Value Series. This program has also been held in association with the Marines Memorial Association. And let me remind you again, if you would kindly remain seated while the general leaves the room.
Could I have one last word?
You sure may.
Say no, I'm going to do it anyway. people defer. Always ask me, what can they do? What can they do to help? And I've got a little pamphlet here that my folks can you can pick one up and you leave, but it's got a couple of ways. And the primary way is a organization called America Supports You. And it's run by the Department of Defense, and it's set up purposely to try to take a bunch of different support requests from around the country and farm them out so that people can help. The other thing I'd ask you to do is just when you have the opportunity and you pass a soldier in an airport, just say thank you. It means an awful lot. And, you know, a lot of whether we keep soldiers in the Army has to do with whether the soldiers believe that the country supports them and what they're doing. And I saw firsthand the power of this. I was in an airport in Phoenix in January coming back from some vacation, and I was sitting next to these two privates who were clearly green recruits. I mean, they were going back to basic training. And I was in civilian clothes, so I chatted them up a little bit. But in the time that I was sitting there, it must have been six people came by and said, thank you. And when they stood up to pay for their lunch, they said, nope, that lady over there got it. So I stood up to leave, and I was walking by him, and the soldier stood up and said, excuse me, sir. He says, aren't you General Casey? And I said, well, yes, I am. He said, I thought you were taller. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great. Well, I'm here to say thank you to you, General Casey. And thanks to all of you out in the audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.